we have begun to look at the first two signs of the seven signs that John crafts together in his gospel. These are prophetic signs in that they point to the fourth telling of who Jesus is and are cumulative, deep, and comprehensive. Why John chooses seven is as seven in the Jewish biblical thought is the number of completeness. And this book is an argument and a testimony destined to convince or designed to convince the reader that Jesus is the Son of God and that belief in him is to have life in his name. Thank you. The process of uncovering Jesus' identity has taken us first to the wedding feast of Cana in Galilee, and how the water used for the purification jars as an intrinsic and vital part of ritual purity of organized religion was transformed into wine, a foretaste of the wedding banquet of the Messiah, where the Jewish expectation was of God will usher in the fulfillment of a new kingdom and authority into an occupied nation. But the miracle points beyond that. Yet the miracle happens off scene. The guests and the maitre d' experience the wine, but it is Mary and the servants who know what actually happened. This is also true of the next miracle, the healing of the nobleman's son. A simple belief of obedience to the word of the prophet Jesus, and then he goes home reassured that his son will live, leaving assured in faith, having left home and arriving before Jesus in desperation. And this faith was rewarded. The servants come and tell him that his son has recovered, and it was the same hour that Jesus gave him his assurance. So he and his household believed. Jesus alludes to the fact, however, that the track record of the role of the prophet is a difficult one. A prophet is not respected in his own country, he said, and that the basis of belief is usually inadequate and therefore insubstantial and open to misunderstanding and error, because none of you will believe unless you see miracles and wonders. And the contrast was drawn with the Samaritan town, who after conversation with Jesus and Jesus staying and accepting hospitality from them, concluded, "We know he really is the Saviour of the world." And now comes another feast. We aren't quite sure which, and this time the miracle of healing will be in public, centre stage, and be both undeniable and controversial. It will be an inevitable tipping point, a decision point as to the organized religion of the day, and of all such humanly organized and controlling systems of thought and personifications of deity, which will inevitably clash with Jesus. And from their point of view, there can be only one outcome. An outcome based on the use of violence, of coercion, of death, and the power of destruction, often through the basis of law. There can be no successful attempts of equality and compromise in the face of healing, freedom, and life. There can only be satisfaction of the need to successfully control, to dominate, and reject. And the Jewish faith expressed at this time is in many senses the best of those systems, not the worst, in trying to retain and hold integrity and truth to a religious way of life that was under attack. But inevitably those two worlds will collide. And in this third sign, this is what happens. John chooses the incident of this healing on the Sabbath, the day of rest. But in the other Gospels, there were other healings that were not on the Sabbath, but also still stirred up religious controversy. including that in Mark 2, where, as far as we know, that didn't happen on the Sabbath, but where Jesus claimed the right to forgive sins and then showed the evidence of it. But there were others, as in Luke 13, of the healing of the woman in the synagogue that Satan had bound for 18 years. And it's interesting to note that the man here, in Paul at Bethesda, had no friends to take him into the water. And we shall see later, he is a difficult and unsympathetic character. Whereas it is the friends of faith that bring the paralyzed man to Jesus through digging through and dismantling the roof where Jesus was speaking. And the woman who comes to the synagogue that day probably was not expecting to be healed, but that indeed is what happens. And in Luke, it's this which he targets is the trigger for what happens next. The furious, the religious authorities ignore the healing, but go straight to the infringement of their Sabbath rules. A concoction of definitions of what it does and does not mean or constitute work on a day of rest, and where it is the enforcing of rules to ensure purity and acceptance to human constructions of liberty and conformity that are in fact an unnecessary and a mistaken burden. Yet this is compounded by what Jesus says in reply to their criticism by the Jewish authorities, who began to persecute him because he had done this healing on the Sabbath, which they considered work on a day of rest. Jesus says, "My Father is always working, and I too must work." And the whole of chapter 5, which includes the next discourse, is so important and so directly linked to this incident of healing on the Sabbath, and explains what happens subsequently in the life and work of Jesus and the basis of it. It's not just a prophetic act of healing. In many ways, the Jews had no problem with that. They were even blasé to the fact of its unaccepted challenge to its evident truth, but focused entirely on the basis of this challenge to their authority, to their view of God. And this saying in verse 18 made the Jewish authorities all the more determined to kill him, not only because he had broken the Sabbath law, but he said that God was his own father, and this way made himself equal with God. And they were correct in understanding the challenge of Jesus to their way of life, but not the basis of it, that Jesus was claiming to be equal with God, for from their point of view, it was actually much worse than that, and which John now explains, and which time precludes a detailed explanation. But before we look at that, is to reflect on the courage of Jesus at this point. He knew the politics of the situation well enough to know that the stakes would be raised. It was a dangerous thing to do, to stick your head above the parapet, to risk life and limb, to be misunderstood, and to be in a position of powerlessness where the power of the state and religion had the authority to arrest, to imprison, and obtain the death penalty. And in many parts of the world today, that freedom of thought and of conscience of belief is not available. It should not be a luxury, but a normality. So was Jesus foolhardy, unrealistic, in expecting he could persuade or overcome such systems, such institutionalized power structures? The Old Testament prophets too experienced and paid the price for defying kings, bringing governments to account, calling for transparency and justice in obedience to God and his covenant, going against public opinion. Is consistency to truth worth paying such a price? Not from a position of power and of counter-violence, but humility, protest, and service. It is perhaps rare that Baptist churches as a movement reflect on their own story within history very much these days. but this biblical conviction for religious freedom is one of them. It remains controversial, and in its day had its persecutors, which primarily were fellow Christians. 1612, published from the religious sanctuary of Holland, Thomas Helways wrote a publication entitled A Short Declaration to the Mystery of Iniquity. In it, he wrote on the flyleaf, which he sent to a copy to the King of England, the King James I, and he wrote this: Hear, O King, and despise not the counsel of the poor. The king is a mortal man, and it is God, therefore, who has power over immortal souls of his subjects, to make laws and ordinances of them, and to set spiritual lords over them. In fact, that does not have the power to do that. And the book feels progressive, even today. You read on it in page 69. For men's religion to God is betwixt God and themselves. The king shall not answer to it. Neither may the king be judge between God and man. Let them be heretics, Turks, Jews, or whatsoever. It appertains not to the earthly power to punish them in the least measure. This is made evident to the Lord the King by the Scriptures. Yet it is one thing to write a critique from the safety from afar. It is quite another to face directly your inquisitors and be at their mercy. He became convinced it was his Christian duty not to flee persecution, but to witness steadfastly to Christ in the midst of it. And so he and his little congregation took ship and returned to English shores that they'd left in 1612. And they announced their presence in this book that was sent to the king. Thomas Helways died in prison 4 years later. The congregation went underground for 30 years. A pointless gesture? Yet it is the articulation of a call to religious freedom that seems so preposterous at the time, is the first articulation of general religious tolerance in the English language, and remains a distinctive, but not always a distinct, part of existing Baptist life. I'm going to read you a quote. There is a path to freedom. Its milestones are obedience, honesty, cleanliness, sobriety, hard work, discipline, sacrifice, truthfulness. And I guess some of us sitting here might say, well, yes, I agree with most of that. But if I read you the final phrase, it will give you a clue where it comes from. And the final phrase is this: and the love of thy fatherland. It's the inscription from the roof of the first concentration camp the Nazis built at Dachau, outside Munich. In 1942, at the pinnacle of Hitler's military success, Sophie Scholl was 21 years old and a student in Munich University. She joined a secret group called the White Rose, made up of 8 students and a lecturer, carrying out non-violent resistance, which consisted of distributing anti-Third Reich leaflets and painting anti-Nazi slogans on walls. It caused a major stir within the whole country. In 1943, she and her brother Hans and their friend Christopher were betrayed to the Gestapo. At their trial, their personal faith, she was a Lutheran Christian, was clear as they challenged the government. They were beheaded within an hour of sentencing. Sophie, as she walked to the guillotine, declared, "How can we expect righteousness to prevail when there is hardly anyone willing to give themselves up individually to a righteous cause. Such a fine sunny day, and I have to go. But what does my death matter if through us thousands of people are awakened and stirred to action? Now today, Dachau is a major tourist attraction. It takes 21 minutes from the Hauptbahnhof of central Munich on the S2 to get near the camp, and from there you take a 726 bus. And you can pick up, alongside the bookshop and the cafe, an audio guide to help you walk around the camp for €3.50. As Christians, is such sacrifice a pointless waste in the necessary business of getting on with life, of earning a living and bringing up your family? What would cause us, about what we believe, to be any different from the vast majority of those that live around us, indistinguishable from their hopes and expectations? The Jews accused Jesus of claiming equality with God. But Jesus bypasses this word altogether. The unity of the Father and the Son is not one of equality, but of love and obedience. It's not equality, it's unity. Equality is about independence, where we stand on our own two feet. It's a very old idea. You can read about it in Genesis. That's not true. You will not die. God said that because he knows that when you eat it, you will be like God and know what is good and what is bad. We need nothing and are independent of any judgment of good and evil other than our own. In contrast, in this clash of authority, Jesus replies in verse 19, "I am telling you the truth. The Son can do nothing on his own. He does only what he sees his Father doing. What the Father does, the Son does also. For the Father loves the Son and shows him all that he himself is doing." And Paul uses this principle to make the point in Philippians 3. Look out for one another's interests, not just your own. The attitude you should have is the one Christ Jesus had. He always had the nature of God, but he did not think that by force he should try to become equal with God. Instead of this, of his own free will, he gave up all he had and took the nature of a servant. The three chapters from 5 to 7 record the shift from hesitation about Jesus to outright opposition and persecution. The first argument about the Sabbath is replaced by a deeper and far more controversial point of who it is Jesus claimed to be. The third sign in turn leads to the third discourse, which turns the attention explicitly to the person of Christ in a clear, formal, systematically orderly, regular statement of account of his unity with the Father, his divine commission and authority. It is only because his relationship to the Father is what he said it was, only because it is what he claimed to be, that he is able to bring new birth, the water of life, the works of healing miracles, and be working continuously on the Sabbath, because indeed, my Father is working, and I too must work. And that is a tipping point. So we come to the Pool of Bethesda, a rowdy sort of place, not a calm sanatorium, but full of the sick, the lame, the destitute. A place for many of hopeless expectation. This is the ultimate in postcode lottery of health. Access to a cure through what John tells us, the popular belief that when the water is stirred, the blind, the lame, the paralyzed, all have the opportunity of being healed. And in later, less important manuscripts, there's a further information given of this superstition that people had, that it was based on the fact that they were waiting for the water to move because every now and then an angel of the Lord went down into the pool and stirred up the water. And it was the first person to get to the pool after the water was stirred that was healed from whatever disease they had. Others assume it was simply the work of an underground spring. But the pools, there were two of them, of Bethesda can still be seen in Jerusalem, in the Muslim quarter, with land owned by the French. And nearby is the St. Anne's Church, which became an Islamic madrasa, or school, after Saladin conquered the city from the Crusaders in 1189. That basilica too is now a ruin and is run by the White Fathers. The chambers and pillars are still partially intact, and give an indication of the size and complexity of these buildings near the Sheep Gate, with colonnades running on all four sides and dividing colonnades between the two pools. They were not small affairs, rather like the size of a municipal swimming pool with deep water, so that someone who was seriously disabled would need help into the pool, even in normal times, let alone in the race to be first. This man has been lying in this place for 38 years, settled in a deep routine. He's institutionalized, probably only able to make money by begging. So his condition was both a cause of his poverty, but also his means of living. He knew no other life. So Jesus' question of him is a real one. Do you want to get well? The man does not directly answer this, but gives justifications for his illness. But why did Jesus single this man out in the midst of so much need clustered all around? I found this on the website. It's a painting by Just Konitz Drukslut. I don't know if the house. What I did for that, Amanda, I can tell by your laughing I didn't. But it gives a nice sense of the raucous, rough, crowded confusion that would have been in that Bethesda pool, of what was going on. And Jesus tells him straight to get up, pick up your mat and walk, and immediately and permanently the man is healed. And then the authorities clamp down on him for carrying his mat. And the man focuses rather on the fact that he was healed, and it was the man's fault because he told him to pick up his mat. And he didn't even know who the man was. But when Jesus makes a point of finding him in the temple area and warning him that his healing was not enough, he needed to heed the fact that, listen, you are well now, so stop sinning or something worse may happen to you. It's not from the argument that all sickness and disability is a result of sin, but that belief in the Son of Man is a whole healing. With the man born blind in chapter 9, Jesus says that the blind would see, and those that see would become blind. The man was healed, but he was still blind. And no prisoner of conscience he makes a point of going and telling the authorities that it was, he now knows, Jesus that healed him. Not to praise him, but evidence for the prosecution to persecute him. So he wasn't really a very nice man. So in closing, there are two things here in considering the needs of others that Paul mentions in Philippians 3. What are the basis of our belief that gives us courage to be different? Jesus did not apparently discriminate between the deserving and the undeserving. Should we do the same?